So I'm now in Atlanta, and you three want to introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Big Mountain.
I'm Joe. I've been involved with Mad Rats Info Shop, Capital Termites Collective, and I'm currently trying to help out with the Atlanta Workers Project.
And I'm David, also with Capital Terminus Collective.
Let's start off with a general discussion about Atlanta itself. How many people in the city?
Is it 3 million? 4 million?
Metro area? City limits? City limits is like a mill. Metro area is 4 mil, something like that.
Yeah. It's been increasing every year.
And in terms of work, what are the main sort of employments?
Service industries and transportation.
And in terms of, say, political issues, you know, what are the main problems you think exist?
Housing, health care, policing, probably in that order. Some people would say health care, with Grady just having been privatized. Our major public hospital was just privatized, so that could be above housing.
Yeah, somebody was talking about the hospital last night, and that was kind of a real top-flight hospital, helicopter pads.
Yeah.
Talk a bit about it.
Grady Hospital was founded in the late years of the 1800s, named after a newspaper editor who was a major local political figure who had said, you know, we need this, who had pushed for it for years before his death. Older Atlantans, you'll still run into people that call it the Gradys, plural, because there were two for a very long time, the Black Grady and the White Grady. And then, I guess in the early 60s, mid to late 60s, they combined them finally. Top flight for any sort of trauma. When there was not a war on, the Army would actually send medical officers to Grady for training in gunshot wounds and other violent stuff. They had excellent diabetes clinic. Well, they have an excellent diabetes clinic, burn unit, cancer care. The emergency room is outstanding.
And it's level one trauma. It's the major level one trauma center in the Southeast. This is also important for convention business. Without a level one trauma center, I think it's due to federal regulations, they couldn't have the convention business that Atlanta does. So there's also a commercial aspect to the importance of Grady.
Problem being, the state of Georgia outside the perimeter, the Beltway Highway around the city, the rural areas hate Atlanta. They think we're like the big tax drain, we're snobs, we're a tax drain, we're welfare frauds, we're black, we're gay, we're everything they're afraid of. So they were unwilling to put money into, counties that would send people to Grady expecting to get them served won't pay into it. So they've been going, plus there frankly was a hell of a lot of mismanagement and corruption and bureaucracy, countless layers of paper shufflers. But anyway, all that aside, it was still a top-flight hospital, is a top-flight hospital, but it was going into an economic spiral that finally somebody came up with this absolutely brilliant plan that apparently has been used at hospitals in other cities in the country. Oh, we'll take it out of the hands of the government and turn it into a tax-deductible charity organization, privatized, and that way we'll be able to get all this huge sums of money from foundation grants, from individual philanthropists, etc., etc. Now, they have no, I don't think they ever had, hard promises, but they said, oh, yeah, we'll be able to get billions of dollars in grants. And the state had promised money on condition that they do it, which I think I read something the other day that they just backed out of that.
They still have promises for money. There's an anonymous donor who's going to promise, I think, $2 million. There's another 40 or 60 million coming from somewhere else, but none of it has been given to the hospital yet. And a lot of the board members that have been, the new board, the new nonprofit board, some of them were from the old board. There's one lady in particular, Beverly, I can't recall her last name, I was just reading in the paper. She makes $300 an hour. She makes $50,000 a month being on the board of Grady. So obviously there's still this bureaucracy, this waste that is going on for these individuals who have now, I guess, cemented their power within the Grady atmosphere. So, you know, what's going to make this any different? They throw a nonprofit name on there to make it sound like it's going to be so much better and that people aren't going to be charged, but the first thing they're going to have to do is cut services to the outside clinics. Mainly the ones that are helping the immigrants on Buford Highway up the road, and some of the more needed clinics that are actually helping people.
Right. One of the things Grady had built up over the years was a network of satellite clinics, and some of those are some of the first things on the board to go.
Oh, we can't forget that it's actually training.
Yeah.
For Morehouse. Morehouse
and Emory.
And Emory. Morehouse being one of the predominant black colleges, that's their only training facility. And so if they lose that, which they probably would, because that costs, of course, it costs money for them to be able to train there. But, I mean, that is also
right. Is
cutting into almost of a, you know, a racist aspect of this, is that they won't receive training, but Emory, the rich white school, is going to be able to handle it just fine. But, you know, no one's talked about Emory losing any of the training.
Right.
They talked about Morehouse. You know, why is that? You know, it's like...
Yeah, that was actually a tactic some lobbyist types were trying to do, was to approach the Board of Trustees of Emory, because Grady was supposed to pay the Emory doctors to come over...
Mm-hmm.
And conduct the training. We're supposed to pay Emory for that. They were several million dollars in debt on that, and people were trying to get the Emory University Board to cancel the debt, which they were completely unwilling to do. I mean, this is it's jokingly called the University of Coca-Cola. They've got so much private money, it's a pity. They're run by the Methodist Church. They're heavily corporate funded. They have no worries. They're not going to go broke. They could waive a few million dollars, but they weren't willing to do it. So that was a factor.
And one of the other things you mentioned was housing. So what's the issue with that?
The housing issue is in the rents and mortgages and home purchase prices are going up astronomically, particularly in the inner city areas, older working class neighborhoods like mine over across the tracks, going up astronomically. When I moved in that neighborhood, it was a slum. Now, the house, the little, rather small house I lived in, which my mother owned, she has been offered, I think, $250,000 for it, which is just ridiculous. You know, it's a small house. You know, no lot to amount to anything. Then they decided, yes, they're going to take all of the public housing projects, the equivalent to council housing in Ireland or the UK, and privatize that. Gut the buildings, most of which they're not in great shape, but most of them were livable, and put in what they call mixed income communities. The thinking is that somehow it's supposed to be good for poor people, working poor, to live with upper middle class people. This is supposed to be, for some bizarre reason that I don't get, this is supposed to make them better people. Oh yes, well, that person over there makes $60,000 a year. They must be, I must model myself on them. But what it does basically is they gut the units, remodel or rebuild, bring in the majority of the units are then filled up with upper middle class people who want to be convenient downtown because of their work or whatever. And then the other people that had lived there are basically
priced out of it.
Yeah, they're priced out. And they're like, oh, well, we'll reserve a percentage of these homes for former residents and other poor people, but most of them are given subsidized housing vouchers for the private market that, A, can be cut off at a moment's notice, and B, it's a hell of a time, particularly with housing prices going up, it's a hell of a time finding a landlord that will want to accept them. There's no requirement that they be accepted. So they're basically screwed.
Basically worthless pieces of paper.
Yeah.
And to mention that the program, which is a Section 8,
right,
is to be phased out by 2010 is the supposed date. So, but they're still telling these people that they're going to be able to live in public housing forever. And they're still telling people that these vouchers are good anywhere and there's plenty of opportunities for them to live. But it's a lie. It's essentially a lie. It's just to get them off their hands for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the city or the state or you know, the federal government trying to help these people to truly for, you know, better education opportunities, better employment opportunities, and better housing. You know, it's mainly neglect is why a lot of those buildings are not as livable as they could be. Instead of doing that, they rather see the profit of turning it into, again, a private enterprise. And that's essentially what these affordable housing or revitalization projects are. It's just an attempt to increase the tax base of the city. And there's other external factors that why the city of Atlanta is clamoring to get rid of these public housing.
Well, the fact that the woman that's the head of the Atlanta Housing Authority is former attorney for a major real estate developer is part of that.
And part of the city of Atlanta. The city of Atlanta resides in Fulton County, and Fulton County is a long, outstretched county that goes into the suburbs. The north part of the county has been threatening for years to break off because it's mainly rich white people.
Well, one section did. Sandy Springs,
Springs
was a huge unincorporated area, lower middle class to just flat out swine rich white folks. I grew up out there. Just said, okay, well, we're having to pay taxes to Fulton County. We're having to pay taxes that benefit, we'd be better off being our own city. So they got a charter from the state of Georgia, and they're their own city, and now no longer support anything that anybody else in Fulton County, including the city of Atlanta, does. So that was a huge hit to the whole county, the county structure, less so the city, but to the whole county structure. That was bad shit. We've had demonstrations, we've packed meetings, we've done handed out flyers all over town.
A lot of stuff has just been closed doors.
Yeah, we've worked with the healthcare workers union at the hospital. It is a unionized hospital, surprisingly enough. And it was like it was a done deal. And they just really didn't, what the workers said, the staff at the hospital said, what the users, the people that use the hospital said, really was not factored in. They didn't care.
Pretty much, well, I'm under the impression that a lot of things, as far as grade, as far as the public housing, these are things that by the time they get to the public consciousness, the deal's already done. Mm-hmm. And people have already, like you said, they're not, people have already been bought generations ago, and they're not going to, like, give up what they gain out of it, you know, just their own power structure. So by the time it gets down to, you know, consciousness of, like, me, who, like, I never even go to Grady, but it's like, by the time it gets to someone like me, it's too late. It's too late.
The media did a great job of making the idea that Grady would actually close, even though it would have never closed. There's no way that the city could have allowed it to close because of the fact of how important it is.
That was the fear element.
Yeah. They threw that all over the news, and that's all that anybody thought. Oh, they're going to shut down Grady. There goes the downtown hospital. You know, and that was it. It scared everybody. So anything that would save Grady, that's quotations, would be a good thing. So you really had no opposition from the general public because of the, how they portrayed the importance and the seriousness of the issue. Not that it isn't serious, but there was no idea that there was no way that it was always right. close.
So the third thing you mentioned was policing. One of the things actually that strikes me coming from Ireland is the sheer numbers of police in the streets. It's actually quite astounding. And squad cars and everything else. It's like, you know, way, way above what I'm used to seeing. So what's the policing issue in Atlanta?
They're way too brutal.
Yeah.
There's been, in the past year, several deaths that, for one instance, there was a elderly lady about 93 years old who was awakened at about maybe 2, 3 o'clock in the morning when her front door was kicked open. It was kicked open by drug police.
Drug squad.
Looking to make a raid. She responded with a shotgun. They responded and killed her. Basically, that's ongoing still. There's been several deaths. There's one guy who was pulled out of his car in Buckhead, shot and killed. And they're still wondering, like, why was this guy pulled out? I myself have been confronted several times by police. And it's not even a matter of, like, black, because I know, like, a lot of white people themselves is like, yeah, it's bad. I've seen, like, where, you know, a white person has totally been brutalized by a police officer. There's an incident where an elderly white lady was at the airport, and she was just for no reason whatsoever, just totally, just, they're just too violent. Yeah. There's no checks at all. I mean, we have probably, outside of New Orleans, one of the most corrupt police forces in the South.
The upshot of the story of the old woman that responded by, one, she was almost completely deaf, and even if they had yelled, "Hey, police," she wouldn't have heard them. The upshot of it was that they had a search warrant based on the word of a petty crack dealer who had told them that somebody was selling crack out of that house, and he was trying to get it. He basically made it up. Two of the officers that were involved in that were fired. I think one may have gone to jail, although they never... Police officers, A, it's incredibly rare for a police officer to be punished for anything like that. B, they never stay very long. But then that led to all sorts of other things, like they found out that the commander of the police, the drug squad, was telling his guys, "I don't care how you do it, just get out there and make arrests." And basically told them, if you have to make stuff up, do it. And, oh yeah, they actually did, when they took her body out, they actually did find, like, a couple of dime bags of pot on the premises. Oh yeah, see? She's a drug dealer. We have evidence. Well, you know, I don't think it actually was hers, but even if it was, that's not evidence of anything other than a very casual pot smoker, which there are elderly people. It's not a kid thing anymore.
There's the Red Dog Squad, which is an elite group of cops also who practice on the public housing residents. We've heard of a few reports from some folks down by the federal prison, where they practice every Tuesday and Thursday, or every 2 weeks, but they're pretty regular days, where they come in and they basically just question everybody. No reason whatsoever. Just jump out, question everybody. They've been known to pull over random folks. I have actually known two or three people that are very, you know, they don't look anything different than anybody else, who've been pulled over for no reason in the middle of the night, unmarked cars. No announcing that they were police officers, but they were obviously police officers by their manner, by the way that they acted. So, you know, you get a lot of that. I've heard a few stories from Big Mountain as well, and got a few late phone calls, I think. But it's in the U.S. it's an ever present thing. Right. There are a lot of cops, and they're always armed. Right. You know, that's the one thing that you have to consider. If there was to be any kind of, if you ever
resistance.
Had a resistance whatsoever, that you have to take it that person is going to resort to a gun. Mm-hmm. So you can't talk to somebody like that. You can't even reason with somebody when it comes down to if they think if you're any threat or that they feel that they can use a gun, they're going to use it. Right. And so you constantly have that about you, even for a speeding ticket, a moving violation, something harmless, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You have that always in the back of your mind.
Now, speaking of the area around the federal penitentiary, the police precinct in that neighborhood, I think it was about 10 years ago, there was a major corruption scandal in that neighborhood. The neighborhood was wide open. It was a drugstore. It was also heavily policed. And somebody started putting two and two together. Actually, the feds came in and started looking at this and said, wait a minute. Yeah, this is, you know, a very major police precinct with a lot of officers assigned to it, but it's also a wide-open drug market. So what's going on? They found out that the police officers in that precinct were being paid by selected drug dealers to arrest other drug dealers and leave them alone. They arrested several cops on corruption charges, fired the precinct commander, and everybody else they rotated out of the neighborhood and put in other assignments and brought in cops that had never seen the neighborhood before on the theory that this would break the cycle, which probably didn't. They probably, you know, it probably slowed things down for a few weeks until some of the cops said, oh, that's why we're here. Oh, well, okay. If it's like that in this neighborhood, where's mine?
So in terms of the anarchist movements in Atlanta, I mean, does any sort of history of anarchism in the city? What's the setup here?
Not pre-80s. Actually, 1979. Well, we had a series of meetings, several of us who had met when they were, the late 70s, they were reinstituting mandatory selective service registrations to the military. There's no active conscription, but there is mandatory registration. And there was a fairly popular movement to oppose that. And we had a fairly widespread coalition here of socialists, civil libertarians, and a handful of anarchists. And the anarchists, we all started getting to know each other through that and started getting together in our own meetings. And as far as we knew, we came up with Circle A, Anarchy in Atlanta, yay! Which as far as we have ever been able to determine was the first anarchist group of any sort in the city of Atlanta.
Christ, I was a founding member of that collective.
Now, beyond that, there may have been some folks around back in the 60s involved in anti-war stuff and civil rights stuff, but we were never able to track anything down. We were never able to verify anything. We heard rumors that, oh yeah, there were a few guys from the IWW, there was a couple of feminists that called themselves anarchists and such like and so forth, but we were never able to verify any of it. So, as far as we knew, we were it.
Much like today?
Much like today.
So what is the situation today?
There's Capital Terminus Collective, there's some independent anarchists, maybe in all 40, you put us all 40, 50, if you put us all in the same room at the same time.
That many?
Maybe.
I've been about maybe 10. I talk to them every day, just about.
No, but I mean, there's about 10 of us that are actually...
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as people that consider themselves anarchists and will come out to stuff occasionally.
Yeah.
And maybe kick in some bucks for a benefit or something like that. There may be 40 or 50.
Do you say that since the punk movement kind of has gone down, that it's mainly been the lifestylists that have been left over that I mean, that's two of the people that I occasionally run into that may or may not identify, and so they're less likely to involve themselves with any heavy political work, really.
Yeah. Yeah, those are the ones I mean. They'll come out something every now and then if it catches their fancy, or if it's something they can do conveniently. But hell, we were lifestylists in the 80s. But and I do think to a certain extent the study of subcultures and such like is important. But organizing, and they're the communities we're in, a lot of us. So that's important to recognize and deal with. But like you were saying last night, Andrew, you have to break out. You have to start talking to people that aren't just like you, which Capital Terminus tries to do. I won't say we've been terribly successful, but we try to do it. We have people like in the labor movement and some of the civil rights organizations that don't look at us like we're complete vampire aliens from Mars or whatever when we come to the meetings and say we're anarchists. They go, oh, okay, there are those guys. They're okay. They show up to stuff. They do stuff. Okay. They're good folks.
Our current involvement, it's been limited, well, not only due to us, but also because of there's an Atlantic Public Sector Coalition that is made up of a few different groups. There's AFSCME, there's Jobs with Justice, there's a disability links. Yeah. So it's a different mix of folks that normally I guess we wouldn't interact with. So we're trying to see how we can fit in and how we can help out with that because we have a lot of the same things in common. So that's mainly what we've been looking at. And then Atlanta Workers Project, which is trying to be apolitical, where it's mainly to be focused on working folks
and the problems that we face in this city.
Right, non-unionized. I gather not. It's organized. It's geared towards working with, even though there are union people involved, it's geared towards working with non-unionized workers.
Non-traditional working class, what people consider working class or unionized type professions. I mean, it's pretty much open to anybody, so it doesn't have that focus. But we're trying to stay away from particular politics because that seems to be a big dividing line for people. You start talking about ideologies or something like that, and it turns people off.
Even though practically everybody in it's an anarchist.
Well, yeah, but we don't have to throw that around. I mean, that's the way that goes.
But, yeah, but that's a starting everyone. That's a starting point.
Yeah, that's everyone. A starting point.
And how about elsewhere in Georgia? Is there any sort of
anarchists?
Scattered.
Yes.
Is that rural Appalachian?
Yeah, there's some folks up in Athens, which is a university town about 60 miles east of here.
They're no longer together.
Although they're no longer together, but they're still there. I know there are like a few people over there that consider themselves anarchists, even though their group broke up for reasons I never quite understood. I don't think they ever bothered explaining. But then there are some scattered individuals around.
Like Savannah would have, my last time I went down to Savannah, talking, hanging out, and they felt if they ever put it all together, they could probably get like 15 people in Savannah. I think it's the state, Georgia will probably reflect the Southeast as a whole, but it's just 10-15 here, then like, our French speaking event last night was in Marietta, and absolutely there was nobody else. And then you can go another 40 miles and you might see two, or you might see someone like, well, they call themselves anarchists, but they're really libertarians. And that throughout the United States, West Coast and East Coast, North, will probably find a greater density of anarchists outside of Chicago.
We've tried to pull people together before. We did last year, just basically kind of a somewhat informal, but just tried to reach out to some of the folks that we kind of knew and get everybody down to, we did it at the info shop one Saturday, and maybe 20 or 30 people showed up. I mean, it's not always convenient for everyone to drive down to Atlanta because it can be such a drive for people outside of the perimeter. And that was, you know, that was, it was useful to talk to people. It wasn't just the usual suspects that we all see every day, but to get an idea of what's going on within their communities. But we haven't really come back together again. That's the thing that I think Atlanta reflects, not just with the anarchists, but with any of the groups, that we all seem to be very separated, very, very, you know, communication is there. There's plenty of tools for communication, but it doesn't seem like we all come together very often. Mm-hmm. There was the social forum, but my personal, you know, reflection was that I didn't even meet anybody from Atlanta, except for the folks that I was going to the social forum with or working with at that point in time. So, you know, that wasn't, I was expecting to meet and find, like, all these people that I'd never met before and who maybe wanted to work together, you know, on anything in particular. I mean, the info shop or some of the other struggles that are going on. And that opportunity wasn't there.
Right.
So it's been very hard to bring people together. I mean, you know, I don't know if it's because of it's geographic or because of there's a lot of groups that have their niches and that they don't tend to stray too much out of that. So it can be kind of hard to bring people together. I mean, I think that's something that we definitely have to work on, regardless if it's anarchist or not.
I think there's more of it because people just have a hard time of like meeting new people. Period. Mm-hmm. You know, and especially if, I think if you're anarchist, you are a little bit not antisocial, but you are just
wary.
Yeah, you're just a little bit. I just don't really want to bother.
Yeah, I think there's a certain level of paranoia. I mean, I know for years I was very cautious about who I talked to about my politics and how I talked about it. They nearly did get my ass kicked in a bar one night. It was during the anti-draft stuff, and I was a little tipsy and talking to some guys about draft registration, and the guy said, "Well, I don't know. I served in Vietnam, and I got drafted and went to Vietnam. It was the best thing ever happened to me," and blah 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 blah. And I said, "So because I went, so I don't see why these young kids shouldn't go." I said, "So you went, and so you—that means you think your kid brother or your son or whoever should go and maybe get their ass killed just because you went." He took me. He was probably about 2 seconds from breaking my nose at that point, and I just said, "Okay, I'm going to shut up now." And he was very angry and very confused and maybe even drunker than I was. So yeah, there are certain moments where I think a lot of anarchists, particularly that are isolated and don't know any other anarchists, they found out about it from the library like I did, or maybe from the internet like I guess most people do now. You know, you don't talk about it much.
In terms of the working class in the city, is it very segregated, you know, along racial lines? One of the things I noticed, actually, when I crossed the border from Florida, there was a huge Confederate flag flying inside of it. And that whole history, I mean, how does that play out in terms of...
Yes and no. Inside the workplace, I think most, particularly like larger workplaces, Atlanta proper, inside the city limits, although it's swinging back, for many years been a slightly majority black city, maybe by like a percentage point or so. Although it's swinging back as part of what they call the new urbanism, which means that all the gentrification process, basically, and a lot of white folks that had left the city are moving back. But inside the larger workplaces, people tend to get along okay. Tend to, not always, but then after work, there's a tendency for everybody to go their own way. Little Five Points in East Atlanta Village are like the hangout neighborhoods where you will actually see some integrated socializing. Other than that, like if you go out to Buckhead, the bars out there are mostly white. The social life out there is mostly white. You go over to West End, the social life out there is mostly black. And then this is a hugely religious, this is the South, this is a hugely religious city. And as actually a minister friend of mine said, Sundays are the most segregated day in the city because there's black churches and the white churches. And you might occasionally get some brave white soul that's a member of a black congregation. You might occasionally get some brave black person that's a member of a white congregation. But mostly, no.
When you were talking about working class, I'd say there's definitely a big line between the jobs, the occupations that people have. I mean, there are a large amount of black folks that are in the service-related industry, you know, customer service, you know, fast food. There are, you don't run into, like, as many, there's definitely not as many black electricians, hardly any carpenters that I ever see. There used to be, but it doesn't seem to be that way anymore. You know, any
union
of the trades.
Union carpenters, a lot of them are black.
I never saw a soul.
Really? That's right.
Well, for a brief time, but even now, like with the real, I do carpentry.
Well, that's just construction itself. That's just a trade that, like, black people just aren't getting into anymore.
Yeah.
And they're ready to go make money doing something else. I mean, it's just like, if you go like into the IT fields, you see a lot of black people in the IT fields. You see a lot of, if you go downtown in the office buildings, you go, you can, it's like 800 employees in a SunTrust bank, 70% of them are black.
And yeah,
it's
and
like they're just not going to, you know. They have the same attitude I have when you mention working outside, I don't know.
And the city workforce from the heights of the bureaucracy to the sanitation workers is probably 90% African American, if not more. At one point, many, many years ago, there was a crew of white leftists. I think there were like borderline Maoists that decided that the thing to do was go get hired on as sanitation workers. And they were probably looked at like complete freaks, but they were there. They were riding the trucks. Yeah, there is. But then in like some of the private industry stuff, like I was for many years a union stagehand at the Georgia World Congress Center. And I was both despairing and very proud of the local union down there because it was integrated. It was actually triracial. It was white African American, probably slightly majority African American, and Vietnamese. And then you'll get odd pockets like that. And we had probably not dues-paying, card-carrying membership, but as referrals working under our contract, we had probably right around 1,000 people. And yeah, I was rather proud of us. I thought, my God, if we'd ever get our shit together and realize how much power this little local has, it would be really something. We are the largest organized body of labor in downtown. We rule downtown Atlanta if we but knew it. You know, and we barely would talk to the city employees who are unionized and who are like, they're right over there, we're right over there, and we hardly, you know, I raised so much hell about that, I actually got myself elected to the city labor council for a couple of terms.
What about both far left and, say, union organization? Are they both kind of very small percentages?
Far left is a joke, basically. We have, let's see, we have the Socialist Workers Party, which is not related to the English or Irish organizations.
There's the Democratic Socialists?
Democratic Socialists of America, who are lovely people but boring as tears. We have the Revolutionary Communist Party, who are a cult.
So, but in terms of numbers, I mean, you know, how many people would we be talking about?
Maybe 20 or 30 active.
Okay, so, yeah, that's what I was trying to put ahead. I mean, so it's not like, you know, there's just basically very little in terms of revolutionary politics.
Right, right, yes, yeah, right, right.
So the question I'm ending all these interviews with is asking people what they make U.S. elections, and in particular the whole Obama versus Clinton thing that's going on at the moment, so.
I have voted at times, but I'm not going to this time. Obama seems like a nice guy. Okay, so what? So what? He's a nice guy. Clinton, I despise. I mean, I will tell people that are loyal Democrats, I say, wait a minute, you're complaining about the Patriot Act, you're complaining about all this stuff the Bush administration has done as far as constitutional infringements, let alone war. You're complaining about all that, but wait a minute. You're complaining about the trade deals and all this. Who signed NAFTA? Bill Clinton. Who signed the Anti-Terrorist Act? Bill Clinton. Why do we trust these people? Tell me again. Why do we trust this organization?
I remember once being at a party out in Snellville, Georgia, and this guy who may be borderline neo-Nazi was there, and he comes up to me and goes like, oh yeah, you're that anarchist, you're that communist guy. And I'm like, I'm not a communist. And he's like, oh yeah, that's right, anarchist, whatever. And he goes up and his closing remark was something about Obama. And I'm like, I'm an anarchist, therefore I'm not voting. And didn't seem to grasp on him that I would change my point. And
former governor of Arkansas, who is a flamingly insane fundamentalist Christian who was running for president.
He's still hanging in there.
He's still running?
Still running. He's still on the ballot. God. You can still vote for him.
What's his name? The guy that used to be one of the cops on Law and Order was running.
Yeah, Fred Thompson.
Fred Thompson. Yeah, he was running on a... He dropped out. He was running on a basically an anti-immigration platform.
Yeah. My personal opinion, and it's been this way for years, is that that people who actually want to obtain that kind of position, they want that kind of power, that they shouldn't be allowed to. Anybody who wants to be a president, anybody who wants to be a politician, by that matter, shouldn't be allowed to. But talking specifically about the main two candidates, and you know, we didn't mention McCain as well, but Obama, I feel, is going to let down the black population. A lot of the folks that I've talked to already, it's great that we've come to a time in the United States history where a black man can actually run for president. But it's so much harder to talk to people about why would this man be any different than, or this person be any different than anybody else that's run for president. Mm-hmm. They have no interest in the working class. They don't come from the working class. The only way that they can win and become president is to play the game, and the game is not for us. It's not there. No one there. It's not Hillary. They can talk about all of their issues. Hillary can talk about the health care. All that she wants, they can pretend that they're going to pull out troops, but it's not. They can't, because it's necessary for U.S. survival for us to clamor for these resources. And Obama knows this, Hillary knows this, everybody that ran for president knows this. And they know, and so why would I trust any of them? I don't care who they are. I don't care if Mickey Mouse ran for president. I don't care if an anarchist ran for president. I still wouldn't vote for him. It's my idea, and I guess it's juvenile or it's immature or naive, is to think that since the system is wrong, and that I refuse to take part in it as much as I possibly can. I know that's kind of a naive, maybe a young anarchist way to look at things, but I just refuse to participate. I voted once when I turned 18, and I voted, like an idiot, for a libertarian. Because I thought, I fell into that trap of going to, you know, a festival and seeing, you know, these libertarian table and talking about the social programs that the Libertarian Party of the United States tends to go for, that I don't have a problem with, but the fact that their economic policies are atrocious, that it's rampant capitalism, that I just soon found that out, and it's like, oh, well, I'll never do that again.